Welcome to Special Sauce, Sirius Eats podcast about food and life. Each week on Special Sauce, we talk with some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Dave Chang and Peter Meehan called and said, do you want to make a magazine? The nice thing about a place like McSweeney's is you can just say yes without thinking about it.
This time, we are excited to have with us Chris Ying, the editor-in-chief of the food magazine we all wish we had the guts to have started, Lucky Peach. Chris had the perfect background for launching a food magazine that breaks all the rules. He was a line cook in restaurants and worked for 5 years at the alternative publishing stalwart McSweeney's, which is where Ying incubated Lucky Peach with chef restaurateur David Chang and food writer Peter Meehan. Chris is the author, along with the editors of Lucky Peach, of The Worst of Lucky Peach, A Treasury of Encased Meat. That is not the verse title for a book, and it's a great read. Welcome to Special Sauce, Chris Ying.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we've been circling around each other for so long that I can't believe that we have to meet over microphones or between microphones or with microphones between us, something. I don't know.
This is actually how I insist on meeting all people for the first time.
So, first of all, we always ask the first question, which is, tell me about life at the Ying family table.
Life at the Ying family table. I grew up in Southern California. My parents owned two Baskin-Robbins franchises and a Mexican restaurant. So I spent a lot of my sort of formative eating years. The Ying family table for me, as it were, was the sort of back stock room at a Baskin-Robbins eating machaca burritos and chili dogs from Wiener Schnitzel. And then at home, you know, we ate dinner together every single night for 18 years, basically. Rice on the table every single night. And it didn't seem like particularly anything special. I think in the last, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, a lot of chefs and food writers and just food people in general who are of a sort of, you know, Asian background have sort of been clued into the worthiness of these sort of first generation or second generation family tables.
Two Baskin-Robbins franchises in a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah.
The bridge was just the immigrant thing, right?
The bridge was that for some reason they were all in Long Beach, where I was born in Long Beach. We lived in Westminster right before it became like a really Vietnamese populated enclave. But no, I don't know. My mom was like, I didn't know her as this person, but she was a trained, you know, microbiologist, pharmacy major, and had this entrepreneurial streak in her that, like, I didn't really ever get to see other than when I was born. We had two ice cream shops, and she had read some article, I think, in the LA Times or heard about this guy who had just, like, a Mexican food truck or a stand somewhere in Long Beach. And, you know, he made all fresh salsas and everything was from scratch every single day. All his, like, chili relleno was from scratch. And so she went and ate there and she loved it. And she said, if I open a Mexican restaurant, will you come be the chef? That's how we ended up with a place called El Loco.
She was a trained
microbiologist researcher.
Did she have a day job in that field?
Yeah, she was working in, I want to say, San Juan Capistrano or something, and, you know, wanted to make some more money. And for some reason at the time, opening a Mexican restaurant and two ice cream stores was the way to do it.
I'm sorry. That's just not the first few things that would come to mind.
No. And it's actually really funny because I was saying to you earlier, like, a lot of people like me, sort of first generation or am I first generation? I was born in the States. Asian Americans have sort of like recognized all of a sudden, like, oh, this the way we ate as kids is interesting to people. And it wasn't honestly until like 6 months ago that I told, you know, I mentioned in passing to probably like Peter Meehan or somebody I've known for a long time that, hey, my parents own these ice cream stores and this Mexican restaurant. And then they were like, what? and it sort of dawned on me that that was like a little bit weird. But yeah, the funny thing about it actually is that you're sort of saying like the only tie between these things is this sort of immigrant thing. Like an Iranian immigrant bought the Mexican restaurant from my mom when she was sort of tired of running it. And then a couple of years later bought the first of the Baskin-Robbins, and then the next year bought the second one.
So I love that. So in Long Beach, these Baskin-Robbins and Mexican restaurants were owned by
Chinese-American
Chinese-Americans, and then they were sold to Iranians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows where this could go?
I know, and I've tried to find that Mexican restaurant, and it's no longer there. But I have like pretty vivid memories of eating there, and my dad talks about it all the time. And you know, there's this thing in L.A. the like pastrami quesadilla is a thing, and I ate that growing up as a kid. Like that was just normal to me.
Right.
But yeah, that's the Ying family table.
And so there was it was more Asian food than American food.
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, we went through sort of phases. There was always rice, sort of no matter what. Just a steamer of rice. Once we sort of got rid of the restaurants and my mom started working as a pharmacist, my dad started cooking, at which point things got kind of creative in the kitchen and we saw some weird...
Did they go downhill or uphill?
Yeah, they went downhill for a little while. I feel bad saying that officially, but there were some like dicey moments where my dad was trying a lot of chicken a la king recipes.
he was testing chicken a la king recipes
just for his own. I don't even know what chicken a la king is or is supposed to taste like. But we had like a lot of different versions. We also had chicken cacciatore. I don't know where. I really should ask my dad like why he was cooking these things at all. But and then
with
he got
rice
better.
And sautéed greens.
No, it was just like a weird onion. Peppery sauce on top of chicken and rice. I don't know what the deal is with that. I have to ask him. But he got better. He got much, much better and then sort of started cooking more Chinese food, which was welcome to us. And now, you know, we always look forward to his, like, lion's head meatballs and Portuguese or Macanese-style curry chicken.
And did he have a day job, too?
Yeah, he worked as an electrical engineer for Hughes Aircraft for 30 or 40 years.
You grew up in a home with a tremendous work ethic.
Yeah. I was it was a pretty tiger parenty situation. And then I lost a little bit of that work ethic. But I'm slowly trying to
well,
regain it.
I think everybody loses the work ethic when you get to college because you're distracted by girls and drugs and alcohol.
I mean, totally. And it's this interesting thing. I don't know if it's my situation is representative of a lot of kids who kind of grew up like me with parents who, you know, would ground me for a semester if I got a B. But as soon as I got to college, I was like, whoa, forget all of this. Like,
right.
There's like a world.
They're not
here.
Around.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I almost failed out of college at Berkeley within a semester just because. You know, I didn't lead a balanced life growing up as a kid.
And so you balanced it by your college experiences.
Oh, yeah. I balanced it big time. Big time.
I think we'll just leave it there rather than get into the specifics.
Yeah.
I read that you considered many different majors in college. You ended up as an English major. What do you remember about your collegiate eating experiences at Berkeley?
My collegiate eating experiences were... It's really important to what I ended up doing, I think. I didn't know what Berkeley was or where Berkeley was when I decided to go there. It was just sort of one of those kind of whirlwind decisions.
Right. And I remember because I graduated from high school in L.A. and you choose three campuses, right, to apply to at the University of California.
Yeah. And so I had chosen Berkeley because – you know, some newspaper told me that that was the best one, and L.A. because that was the second best one, or whatever the case was. I ended up going to Cal. I had a vague idea that, you know, in 1968, there was an important thing that happened there for the civil rights movement, you know. But that was basically it. And I cared about that, and that meant something to me. But I also didn't know about Alice Waters and Chez Panisse and... you know, everything that happened across the bay in San Francisco and Zuni and Judy Rogers. And I had no idea what any of that meant. And to be honest with you, growing up, I had never eaten at a restaurant like those places. I'd never eaten actually at like a fine dining American restaurant. Every time we went out to eat, it was Chinese food. You know, big banquets and really interesting food in that way. But I'd never sat down at a restaurant that served wine.
Right.
And then I was in Berkeley and kind of started discovering this thing and discovering what it meant to shop at markets like Berkeley Bowl or at the farmers markets, and started cooking for my friends. And it's funny, I just started cooking the things that my parents cooked for me, for my friends. And that was like actually that first moment of sort of discovery.
So what were three dishes that you cooked for your friends?
So I cooked, it's funny, I would cook this, you know, like really traditional Chinese steam fish, you know, where you steam it and then you sort of shower it with sliced ginger and cilantro and scallions, and then you and soy sauce, and you kind of house it with this hot oil and sear all of those herbs. But the way my parents had always done it, they would just get like a sea bass or something and then cut three, you know, slits into it and then wrap it in plastic and microwave it. And that was how we steamed it. And so I made that. And like my friends were kind of blown away by this idea of microwaving a fish.
Right.
I made my dad's version of they call it Portuguese chicken, but it's like the curry chicken from Macau. Super coconutty. Everything is fried twice before it's braised in the coconut.
Ooh, sounds delicious.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, but it's just like a heart attack. And then I got into the Food Network at that point. I was like wearing down the number 3 and 5 on that remote. just watching. It was like the prime, in my opinion, of the Food Network when it was, you know, Bobby Flay and Mario Batali and
right.
Ming Tsai all just had like kind of the stand and stir shows. And I couldn't get enough of any of them. And so, like, I remember one dinner party we cooked at the house I shared with some friends was just, like, this random medley of things that I had seen on TV and just decided to try to cobble together and cook again. So, you know, it was, like, Ming Tsai's, you know, macadamia nut crusted halibut with, like, Bobby Flay's mango salsa. It was just, like, an advertisement for the Food Network. But I was, like, I was getting real joy out of cooking.
Yeah, you were getting turned on.
Yeah, it was like it was this epiphany, honestly. Like I'd always been like this chubby kid who liked eating, but like now
welcome
this was a
to
thing.
The club.
Right? It's like at a certain point you discover all of us discover that, oh, this thing that I just sort of like, other people also like. And honestly, for the last 15 years it's been that discovery over and over and over again, and you know, you know, I know we talked about it. It's a funny way to meet one another sitting here between microphones talking about food. But like you and I share this thing.
Yes.
And you keep discovering new people with different interests and different expertise and different backgrounds who share this thing. And, you know, the joy of that has like really driven my career for the last whatever it is, 5, 10 years. And but yeah. And then at Cal, I try to be kind of like too cool to participate in normal student things. I didn't want to be.
You didn't want to be in the AV club?
Yeah, I was trying to impress girls and be sort of this outsider. So I walked into a restaurant one day and asked for a job and kind of sweet talked my way into it. And then started cooking at this restaurant that had kind of descended from the Chez Panisse ilk. And, you know, the rest is kind of.
That's crazy. You walked in. Did you have any knife skills?
Zero knife skills. I had zero idea what I was doing. I'd probably cooked for my friends 4 times.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd read Kitchen Confidential, I think, by that point. I think I had some idea of what being a line cook meant, theoretically.
Right. In some really highly theoretical
yeah,
way.
Yeah. But, I had this crazy fortune of walking into this restaurant where the chef was this guy, David Stevenson, and he had graduated from Cal, and he was really kind of like gruff, but like a super sweet guy underneath that veneer. And I asked him, you know, I don't know what I'm doing at all, but I would love to try to be a cook, you know. And he walked up to the sous chef at the time and said, "Do we need anybody who doesn't know anything?" And,
what a great introduction.
No, I know. And I don't think that the sous chef knew that he was referring to me, who was standing next to him. And she just said, no. But I think by that point, like that joke, he had already decided to give this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very interesting point that you're bringing up, which is that chefs actually want motivated people more than experienced people, because they basically have to unteach you things. You have to right. unlearn them. They'd rather they have a blank slate who's really passionate about what they're about to do.
And not only is the kitchen, the language of the kitchen so specific, but every specific kitchen has an even more nuanced language. You know, it's a way of doing things, the way of referring to things, where things are. You know, going into a different kitchen, half of the battle is figuring out where things are.
Right.
You know, and I think that, or how the chef wants things done or stored or labeled or whatever the case may be. And so, yeah, you come in with this just person who's basically just putty, but willing to sort of be shaped and listen and has some degree of physical coordination. That's sort of an ideal starting point.
Yeah.
It doesn't work out a lot of the time.
Sure. No. I think, but that's part of it is like that not everyone is going to work out. But the reason they're not going to work out is not because of the level of knife skills going into the job.
Yeah. I mean, 3 months in,
right.
It might
that's
be
a different
case.
Story.
But yeah, for sure. I think that it's more about, yeah, being able to learn and adapt and try hard.
Yeah. So how did you get from there to McSweeney's?
So I cooked through my sophomore, junior, senior years, and then for the, you know, half year after that, when I was just kind of lingering at the same restaurant, I never thought I would be a chef. I never thought I would really be a cook long term. I really loved it, but somewhere in my head, like, it still hadn't clicked for me that there were these other possible paths besides go to school again, get a job doing something that you learn to do. And so cooking was still this thing, and food in general was still just this, I don't know, hobby or mm-hmm. I didn't want to mix what I was doing in my spare time with what I was doing in my, I don't know, real time.
Right.
And it took, you know, 5 or 6 years for me to realize that, like, oh, this thing that I really love and care about and, you know, spend most of my time thinking about is what I should really be doing. Anyway, long story short, I didn't think of cooking as my path forward. Plus, I wasn't super good at it. And I wanted to do something in writing and literature and English, which is what I had studied. So I sent another sort of cold call plea to McSweeney saying, you know, I know nothing about anything.
That is such a great rap. I'm going to incorporate that. Like, when I meet somebody, I'm just going to say, I don't really know anything about what
yeah,
you do.
I think that's the way to, you know, you try to, like, show that you know too much and it turns people off, I guess. But no, I was sort of trapped at that point. I had moved down to Southern California for a month or two and was kind of caught in this Orange County bubble again that I had worked so hard to get out of. And I emailed the editors of the Believer magazine and McSweeney's and said, you know, can I have this unpaid internship? And they said, sure. And then it started again. It was sort of this exact same experience as cooking where I went to McSweeney's. I didn't know who Dave Eggers is. Dave Eggers is the founder and editor of McSweeney's.
Author of A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
Yep.
Which could have been about my life, by the way. I had a very similar.
Is that true?
No, true.
Oh, really?
No, totally true. I was raised by my older brother after my parents died.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm
from
a big
what
Dave
age were
fan.
You? What age were you?
12 when my dad died and 15 when my mom died.
Oh my God! Yeah, that's exactly like Toph was.
In fact, it was really hard to finish that book.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you know, I didn't read it until this is funny. Like I started my internship at McSweeney's. I didn't know who Dave was. Or I sort of knew who he was, but I had actually come because of the Believer magazine, which was this, you know, really brilliant, pretty cerebral magazine about art and literature and music. And that was what was my entry into McSweeney's. And we walk into the office one day and the managing editor of the Believer, Andrew Leland, is touring me around. And there's this sort of disastrous desk with like just like Dr. Seussian shelves coming out of the wall and just mail hanging everywhere. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. So he had just nailed just drawers onto the wall and those were his like inboxes and just papers were spilling everywhere and there was just nowhere to put anything on this desk. And Andrew said, oh, that's Dave's desk. If anybody calls, just say Dave isn't here. And I was like, okay, this Dave guy seems weird. I don't know who Dave is. And then I went home later that night and kind of put two and two together. I was like, oh, I work for Dave Eggers now. And I went and I picked up Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, which, you know, Dave has been through so much at this point. Dave has been become this kind of poster child for that kind of indie writing, that kind of indie publishing. Yeah. You know, McSweeney's was called Twee more times than I can possibly count. You know, hipster, whatever. Like, it's the
yeah. Some people called it McTweeney's.
Yeah, McTweeney's. It's the proto Portlandia. But like that being said, I still think that that book is amazing, and I read that and one sitting and was just, you know, misty-eyed and in awe of this person that now I was getting to work next to. And I'm sure your experience reading that book must have been so yeah. intense. And, you know, if you haven't read the book, you know, it's a memoir, but, you know, in that kind of metafictional way where it's sort of playing with the form a lot and keeping you sort of on your toes about, you know,
time and place
and reality. And but then... Exactly. And then you meet Dave and you meet his little brother who he raised when his parents died. And then his sister actually committed suicide. And it's this really sort of strange experience at that point where it feels even more real to see like it's like meeting a character in a book that you really love. But anyway, so I worked for him for a long time, and basically it was just like The Kitchen, where I didn't know much. I had worked on my high school newspaper, so I knew some degree of editing and page design, sort of, as much
right.
as a high school student knows anything.
Yeah, high school newspapers. I don't know, man.
But you know, one day, you know, Dave was in the office, and he said, we've got to lay out this book about exonerated prisoners. We're doing oral histories of exonerated prisoners. And I raised my hand and said, hey, I can do page design. Can I lay that book out? And, you know, the nice thing about Dave is he sort of rewards that kind of initiative. And I had no idea how to use. We were using this program called Quark at the time. So I went home and I learned Quark through some online tutorials and then just started laying out this book. And, you know, then it was like, okay, like we're now starting this series of oral histories and we need somebody to kind of head this up. And I was like, oh, that's probably me.
But that's
again.
The great thing with those kinds of places is that yeah. if you did have the initiative, since they didn't have the money to pay professionals.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, Chris is down for that.
Yeah. I mean, it's the best part about that and sort of the worst part, or you're hitting on both of those, you know, like on the one hand, there was this article in the New York Times, maybe like 8 years ago, that was sort of talking about this like unpaid intern economy that like much of the creative world had become run on, and you could only join in this creative world if you had parents who could support you while you were doing this unpaid internship. You know, I was cooking at another restaurant in San Francisco for a little while, but really it was because my parents were paying the way,
right?
Before I started getting paid there, but on the other hand, the best part about that sort of place is that when, you know, 5-6 years later, when Dave Chang and Peter Meehan called and said, hey, we got this thing. Lucky Peach wasn't really a concrete idea yet.
Right.
It was just a thing. We're going to shoot all this video, get all this material. We're going to be researching all these topics. Do you want to make a magazine? Like, the nice thing about a place like McSweeney's is you can just say yes without thinking about it.
You know,
you don't have to do any sort of P&Ls or talk to a million people. You just say, hey, one of the world's best chefs, one of the world's best food writers are asking if we can do a food magazine together. We can do it however we want. Why would we say no to that?
Right. We'll start as a quarterly. There won't be many upfront expenses.
Yeah. I mean, we don't even honestly, like, I was in a crappy burger place and we sort of wrote down some rough numbers on the literal back of a napkin and away we went. So,
you know how many business plans have been written, at least apocryphally, on the backs of napkins.
I know.
I want to see those napkins.
Right? I feel like people should be keeping those napkins.
If you could do a magazine just of napkins of business plans on a napkin.
Right, but like the thing with a napkin is that you never it's so unimportant at the time. You know, you write it down, then you wipe your mouth with it, and you throw it away. Like if
that
anybody
takes care of the year three projections.
Right. If anybody thought that their napkin was going to be worth something, they wouldn't be writing it on the back of a napkin.
Exactly. So it didn't really. And what was the? They sort of came to you and they said, "Okay, we want to do a magazine. We may have this thing, and maybe an app. It's called Lucky Peach. We're shooting a bunch of video." And then how did it actually take shape as a magazine?
About a year before Lucky Peach started, McSweeney's had done this thing called the San Francisco Panorama, which was a, I want to say, 320-page broadsheet newspaper. And this was, I mean, you must remember this. It was, you know, the internet was really growing an unbelievable clip and outpacing print. And everyone was saying newspapers were done. By the end of the year, there will be no more newspapers.
Right.
There will be no more books. You know, everything will just be fed into our brains directly by laser beam. And Dave Eggers' thing had always been the printed object. And again, you know, if you're not super familiar with McSweeney's, all of the books and magazines and everything McSweeney's publishes are these sort of grand objects, these beautifully carefully designed and illustrated and thoughtfully considered things.
But they celebrate print.
In print, yeah. And they, you know, they had a website that was just like one long infinite scroll of like literary jokes. But that was it. And in reaction to this death knell of newspapers, we decided to put out, you know, our prototype for a newspaper. And there was going to be this food section. I did not want to be in charge of the food section. You know, this was just not that interesting to me. The newspaper in general had kind of caused this rift at McSweeney's between sort of Dave and the staff. The staff kind of thought, like, this is a little too much for us. We can't handle this much work. You're trying to turn us into a newspaper staff overnight. And, you know, Dave, to his credit, never gives up on an idea and was sort of rallying all the interns to help him put this newspaper together, while the sort of senior staff, we were kind of like, let that kooky weirdo do his thing and we'll just be over here. And then one day I saw sort of the rough layout for the food section sitting on a table, and it was being run by this kid who, you know, to his credit, was kind of trying to like put a food section together from what he knew. He was an Alaskan rugby player. So, you know, the lead story was going to be, you know, how to refuel after rugby practice and, you know, like six ways to eat Alaskan. And I'm looking at this thing just thinking, I can't abide by this. This is not okay anymore.
I can't even be associated with
right?
anything like this.
Yeah, and so that was, honestly, that was it. That was the moment where I said, okay, I'll take over this. I'll do the food section. And this was 2008, 9, when the Momofuku cookbook was coming out. And just by chance, I had a galley of the Momofuku cookbook. I don't even know why I had it or how I got it. And I was having this realization reading that book, you know, that again, we've been talking about this idea that food connects us not only to, you know, other food people, but to people who have interests that range all over the place. You know, Peter and Dave wrote this book that was telling this amazing story about creativity and struggle, and there were these two guys who had interests that were so wide-ranging and didn't just pertain to pork and
right.
uses for pork. And I was in love with this book, and I said, like, we should excerpt a recipe from this, but we'll redesign it in like a crazy way.
So that's how you got to know them.
Yeah, so I got to know them this way, and Peter reached out actually after the publicists for Clarkson Potter, who I now love and know, sort of said, like, no, you can't do this. And he reached out and said, I'm a huge fan. Do whatever you want. Have whatever you want from the book. We worked on this thing together and really hit it off and talked a lot about what we liked about publishing, what we didn't like about food writing, what we didn't like about food publishing. And, you know, I designed this thing for them. And I remember getting this email forwarded from Peter, from Dave, that was like, this is the guy. We should have got this guy to design the book, you know. And so we clicked on that level. And then a year went by, and Peter and Dave share that same affinity for printed objects or just, you know, things with that are crafted. And they called me when they were, I think, still shooting things that would become Mind of a Chef.
Right.
And said, we've got all this stuff. You know, you shoot 200 hours of material to make a 20-minute TV segment. We've got all this knowledge. Let's make a magazine.
And so that was the elevator pitch.
That was the elevator pitch. That was it. That was the whole thing. The conversation in my mind, I think, was 20 seconds and then Lucky Peach existed.
And did you think about, like, you were going against the grain, that as everyone was fleeing the magazine world, you were doubling down?
A little bit. I mean, that was deeply ingrained in the McSweeney's mindset. It's one of those things that, you know, you repeat it so many times, you're not sure what it means anymore. You know, print. We love print. I love print. Print is important. And it was just sort of our thing. So I didn't give it a second thought when it was time to make a print magazine. It was just like, no, that's what we do. And we'll do a good job. So
right. And we'll just write about stuff we're interested in.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, I mean, we weren't for a long time, we were kind of pegged as this sort of like rebel punk zine thing. And I've said this to other people before, but like, you look at me, I've never been punk in my life. I'm scared of punks.
You don't have a Ramones poster?
I don't have a Ramones poster. My hair won't even go into a mohawk. I can't do any of these things.
That's funny. So what were the influences? Like, what were some of the inspirations that you guys had in your head for the magazine? Were there other magazines? Were there writers? Were there artists? Were there...
Yeah. My whole sort of editorial style and visual aesthetic was informed by what I had done at McSweeney's before. I wasn't one of these kids who read all sorts of literary journals and indie zines and things and had this backlog of information. I just knew what I had been working on for the last 6 years or something. So, of course, illustration and the illustrators we worked with at McSweeney's were going to come into play. You know, oral history has always been this bedrock of what I do as an editor. You know, that was the first thing I ever worked on at McSweeney's, was this program called Voice of Witness, you know, documenting human rights crises with oral history. So, you know, Studs Terkel and the way he worked has always informed how, you know, I like to work with people to help them tell their stories. You know, Peter had had you know, so many years of food writing experience under his belt, and Dave had so many years of being a cook and a chef and this inside access to all these people that really informed what we did. I was a fan of food magazines. You know, I read Savour and Gourmet, and I remember actually when the, I don't know if it was the first one, but it was the New Yorker food issue that had the long Batali profile that Bill Buford wrote.
Right, that sure. That became the book.
That was before I knew anybody in food, and that issue was just remarkable to me.
So that showed you the possibilities.
Yeah, you know, no like light bulb popped over my head. It was just these were the things that I liked.
Sure. So, I mean, you break all the rules. You have poetry and fiction, and the layout of Lucky Peach looks nothing like Bon Appetit or Savour or Food and Wine. And yet Lucky Peach is not just surviving, it's thriving, right? And does that surprise you, or do you constantly go, when is everyone going to discover that, you know, they shouldn't be reading this and that paying $10 or $12 an issue is not the way to go? Like, what explains your success?
I think it's a little bit, and you can correct me if you think this is wrong, but I think that what makes Lucky Peach successful in a sort of different form is the same thing that makes Serious Eats successful, is that rather than sort of doubling down on what current media trends tell us we should do, which is quick hits of minimal information that appeal to as many people as possible, Lucky Peach is, as a print object, was always about giving people more. As mm-hmm. every other print publication and newspaper was sort of thinking, crap, we need to shrink.
We need
to save money.
Right. We need to reduce information to nuggets.
To nuggets.
And we wanted to be the definitive banquet for anything that we cover.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, that's the foundation of the success that you guys have found, is being exhaustive and authoritative and sort of being trustworthy as something that's not just going to scrape the surface and pull from somewhere else. And, you know, that wasn't – being authoritative wasn't what we were necessarily doing, but in its way, we were trying to give people more than they thought, more than they were being told they deserved from.
About a given subject.
About anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. More pages, more
right.
art, more
right.
whatever.
You're more not stuff to look at.
More stuff
more
to look
words
at.
To read.
Right? That was the key to our success, I think, honestly.
And how would you describe your duties at Lucky Peach?
My duties at Lucky Peach have shifted a little bit over time, but not that much. From sort of day one, it's been this small staff making the magazine. You know, as a team, we sort of always sort of haggle and bargain and argue about what the themes are going to be early on, and then assign all these articles. Some, you know, we come up with the ideas and ask writers to write about them. And then I read and edit every single thing that is in the magazine. You know, I've been a part of the design process sort of from day one, laying out pages and things like that, informed by our sort of more talented art directors. I definitely take a subordinate position to them, but I'm good at InDesign, so I just sort of – I do a lot of dirty work of InDesign, but a lot of it is just sort of track changes in Microsoft Word. That's my bread and butter.
Track changes in Microsoft Word. That's going to be your epitaph?
That's going to be my epitaph, hopefully, yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about the worst of Lucky Peach, which you deserve a MacArthur Genius Award just for the title.
Yeah. I mean, that was half the reason to do the book.
But it's also a damn good book. And what was interesting to me was, and I don't know if this is what you're trying to do. In a way, it was encyclopedic about the brief descriptions of every kind of sausage. Mm-hmm. Although there was a remarkable paucity of American hot dog styles. but anyway, and then there were these longer pieces and rants. And by the way, I completely agree with your rant about why anyone bothers to make homemade ketchup.
Right?
House-made ketchup is one of the silliest conceits that has totally taken over the restaurant business. I just had the owner, one of the owners and founders of Sweetgreen, started telling me about Sir Kensington. I was like, tastes like tomatoes. It doesn't have sugar. Well, it's like,
who cares?
It doesn't taste like Heinz. That's the problem.
Right, exactly. I'm so glad that you said that because people have read the book and said, so what is your problem with homemade ketchup? And I'm like, what isn't your problem with homemade ketchup? Why do you want to make this thing that's wonderful a little bit worse, you know?
But so the book is in some ways an encyclopedia of sausage styles all over the world, encased meats. But I think you, from reading the book, I found that most of the people who wrote it in it have a kind of love-hate relationship with encased meat. Would you say that that's an accurate assessment?
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think that what we tried to do wasn't necessarily an encyclopedia. I knew from the beginning we were never really going to cover every single sausage under the sun. And I knew that, honestly, from sort of like reading Serious Eats and comment boards and things like that, that no one was ever going to be fully satisfied with our coverage of sausages. So the goal was to sort of approach it with this sense of wonderment and kind of like, oh my God, can you believe this sausage exists? And cover the things that were interesting to us. And so that love-hate way that the writers talk about it where, you know, for example, Gideon Lewis Krause, who's an amazing writer, who isn't, you know, ostensibly a food writer, but did his Fulbright scholarship in Berlin.
Right. Hates Curryverse.
Hates Curryverse, which to the chagrin of lots of the readers of this book. So in talking about what it is and describing it, a lot of what he does is just rant about how much he hates it and how gross it is. So I found that to be a kind of more interesting way of approaching things was to inject a little bit of opinion, you know, rather than reading a just description of something. Like, you can get the gist of what it is from reading Gideon's screed about it, but you also get to, like, be entertained by
right.
how much he dislikes it.
Right. In a way, it's very Lucky Peach-like in its approach.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm trying to approach these things with, like, a little bit of a different angle.
Yeah, and also you're not taking, you know, it's not supposed to be this definitive encyclopedia of
definitely not
encased meat. You know, it's like you have an ability to laugh at yourself. So, I mean, it's a really cool book, but you know, you've done a bunch of cookbooks, Lucky Peach cookbooks, and you have a website that's nominated for a James Beard Award. In fact, you're going up against Serious Eats, dude. But it doesn't matter, Chris. Now that we've met, we're cool. It doesn't matter what happens. And you're doing events. I mean, Lucky Peach has become the B word, right? A brand,
mm-hmm.
Which is probably not what you ever set out to do. But is that what keeps you going? Is that what makes it keeps it fresh?
I'll be honest with you. That's not what keeps me going. The brand aspect of it isn't. And I think it's fine. I think that we have brought on really smart, really talented young people onto our staff who will grow Lucky Peach into a brand and who are going to be way better at doing that than I am.
Yeah, that's just like me in Serious Eats. And it's like, you know what? It's cool. Everyone says, well, do you mind that it's not you anymore? It's like, it's the greatest thing ever.
It is the greatest thing ever.
To gather talented young people and let them do their thing.
Yeah.
And watch them take flight is a pleasure that I never thought I would experience or never knew could evoke that much pleasure.
No, I share that with you, and I look at the staff we have now and what we're doing, and I look at this thing that basically three of us made, me, Peter, and Dave made this thing, and I see our staff, some of whom have been with us almost as long as we've been doing it, love this thing as much as we do.
Yeah, it's so interesting that there's so many parallels to Serious Eats.
It's crazy, right? You hire people who, you know, it's your baby, and other people love your baby as much as you do. And it's just like, oh, that's a little weird.
But, yeah, no,
but
it's
amazing. I love it. And I mean, just to the brand thing, I'm so excited about all of these things we're doing. I love the events we've been putting on and the books and the website. And I'm really excited to kind of work in these different mediums and try and do what I'm good at. But I've never been – I worked at McSweeney's for
right, so they were not brand-based.
I'm not a good guy growing a business, so I admit that.
Got it. You said something in a piece for Bon App that – about going on a diet for your wedding that I related to so much. It was something to the effect that you realize that not every meal has to change your life. And for people like us, right, because we love food and we live for those moments.
Mm-hmm.
We live for those moments where we're transported. Oh, that's what this is supposed to taste like.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize that, you know, it's like this old New York Post writer, Jerry Nachman, once said, I realized after 50 years that you could eat too many spare ribs.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly – exactly the feeling I have at least two or three times a week. No, you know, I'm not, you look at me and I'm not like a diet guru, so it has nothing to do with like my helping people lose weight or anything. But, you know, I mean, have you ever had a moment where you were traveling or you were hell-bent on some restaurant or food objective?
Right.
Where you were like, I'm not having a good time seeking this out. This
totally.
Is not fun anymore.
You know, I used to tell people sort of somewhat kiddingly, you know, the great ones learn to eat with pain.
Mm-hmm.
But you really don't have to.
You really actually. Don't.
You really don't. And that was one of the things I took away from reading that piece. And part of that is every meal doesn't have to change your life. That, as you say, you can have toast and a banana for breakfast on the day that you're going to hit 10 sausage places.
Right.
And it's okay.
Yeah, I think that that's the only way I can survive. I mean, there are special people. There's like, you know, Jonathan Gold seems to never not love eating.
Right, right, yeah.
Crazy meals, but I can't. You're going to drive yourself crazy trying to make every single meal the best meal you've ever had.
Yep, I agree. All right, it's time, Chris, for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. It's only 5 minutes long, so it shouldn't be too painful. So what's in your desert island fridge?
What's in my desert island fridge?
It has electricity, so you know, you have access. People can fly in anything.
Okay. Probably some leftover curry chicken that my dad cooked.
Okay.
I assume I have some way of reheating things in this.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you have a full kitchen.
You know, I'm not a huge beer drinker, so I would say, you know, a bottle of, you know, Ravenau, some white burgundy.
All right.
And some curry, and I'll live on a desert island.
That's it. Just two things. I like the simplicity of the way you think.
Yeah, what else am I going to do? I'm on a desert island. You know, what else am I going to do there?
So who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
My last supper.
Could be people living or dead. Could be people you always wanted to meet or people you know. Would Chang be there?
He's probably the one who killed me. So he's probably there waiting to end my life. Chang's probably there. You know, I would sit down and have dinner with President Obama. I would love to do that.
All right, that's good. Obama and Chang. But you're worried about Chang.
This is an insane dinner table.
Dave Eggers?
That's a tall order for me. Dave does not like to eat.
Oh, all right.
So Dave's not invited.
Okay, Dave is definitely not invited.
I would have always liked to have shared a meal with David Foster Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
He, in my younger years, I thought I could write like him, and I tried to imitate him a lot when I was younger and realized that he was sort of too special for that.
Mm-hmm. One more.
Helen of Troy.
Helen of Troy. All right. I love this. All right. That's all. That is – I've never had that answer before. That is awesome. So what are you eating?
There's rice.
Okay.
For sure. There's a plate of my dad's curry sitting there at my last meal for sure. I'm going out. I try to avoid eating too much fin fish because of environmental concerns. But I guess if it's the end of me, I'm going to have a little bit of tuna there. I've honestly never been able to answer a question about a last meal.
Yeah, that's all right.
I fear death too much.
So, and what's your guilty pleasure that in the dark of night – you're by yourself.
Oh, I've just indulged in this yesterday. I have like a sick problem with being able to turn down like a supermarket California roll.
So it has to be a bad sushi California roll made with surimi that's been refrigerated, so the rice is incredibly gummy.
Yeah, I can't.
Okay, that is the weirdest and most wonderful guilty pleasure I've ever heard.
I can't get away from it, and I had at least two little plastic tubs of it at the airport yesterday. Like it's really guilty and dark.
That's funny. So one person, living or dead, that you would love to break bread with over lunch?
Probably AJ Liebling.
AJ Liebling.
I would love to witness that lunch and share in it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Chris Ying. Get yourself a copy of The Worst of Lucky Peach. It's a terrific book that actually made me jealous because it's the kind of book I wish I had thought up. And subscribe to Lucky Peach. You don't have to be food obsessed to enjoy it, but it probably helps a little. Thanks again for coming, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.